This is the first day of this two-day February 2014 session, and I'm going to be reading from a Zen teacher, Charlotte Joko Beck, drawn from this well a few times before. Say a little bit about her. She was the third Dharma heir of Maizumi Roshi, who's a teacher in the Zen Center of Los Angeles. And she established her own center in San Diego, taught there for a number of years. I believe she's died now, and there are others teaching there. Incredibly clear and original voice, and I just find she has so much to say that it's easy for me to relate to, so that's a good thing for me to use for a talk. I'm going to be reading here, starting with a section entitled True Suffering and False Suffering. Can't get any more Buddhist than that. These are all edited versions of talks that that she gave, usually in Sesshin, but also at other times. And I'll just start right in here. It says, yesterday I was talking to a friend who recently had a major operation and has been recovering. I asked her what would be a good subject for a Dharma talk, and she laughed and said, patience and pain. She found it very interesting that in the days immediately following her operation, the pain was clear, clean, and sharp, and it was no problem. Then, as she began, became a little stronger, the mind began to work, and the suffering began. All her thoughts about what was happening to her began to appear. I worked for some years as a nurse, on the adolescent ward at Strong Hospital here in Rochester. And that is a pretty common pattern. People start to complain. It's a good sign that they're getting better. Joko goes on, in a way we sit for no purpose. That's one side of practice. But the other side is that we want to be free from suffering. Not only that, but we want others to be free from suffering. So a key point of our practice is to understand what suffering is. The Buddha said, I teach but two things, suffering and the end of suffering. She says, if we really understand suffering, we see how to practice, not just while sitting, but in the rest of our life. We can understand our daily life and see that it's not really a problem. It's just a big thing to see. To what extent is that true for anyone? Understand our daily life and see that it's really not a problem. A few weeks ago, someone gave me an interesting article on suffering, and the first part of it was about the meaning of the word. I'm interested in these meanings, their teachings in themselves. The writer of this article pointed out that the word suffering is used to express many things. The second part, fer, is from the Latin verb fere, meaning to bear. And the first part, suff, is from sub, meaning under. So there's a feeling in the word to be under, to bear under, to totally be under, to be supporting something from underneath. Now, in contrast, the words affliction, grief, and depression all bring images of weight, of something bearing down upon us. In fact, the word grief is again from the Latin gravare, which means press down. So there are two kinds of suffering. One is when we feel we're being pressed down, as though suffering is coming at us from without, as though we're receiving something that's making us suffer. And the other kind of suffering is being under, just bearing it, just being it. And this distinction in understanding suffering is one of the keys to understanding our practice. I've sometimes distinguished between suffering and pain, but now I'd like to use the word suffering and distinguish between what I call false suffering and true suffering. That difference in understanding is very important. The foundation of our practice and the first of the Four Noble Truths is the statement of the Buddha that life is suffering. He didn't say it's suffering sometimes. He said life is suffering. I want to distinguish between those two kinds of suffering. Often people will say, I certainly can see that life is suffering when everything is going wrong and everything's unpleasant. But I really don't get it when life is going well and I'm feeling good. But there are different categories of suffering. For instance, when we don't get something we want, we suffer. And yet, when we do get it, we also suffer because we know that if we can get it, we can lose it. It doesn't matter whether we get it or don't get it. If it happens to us or doesn't happen to us, we suffer because life is constantly changing. We know we can't hold on to the pleasant things, and we know that even if unpleasantness disappears, it can come again. In other words, we're never safe. There's never that place to rest where everything's okay. Some people come into Zen, aspiring to come to awakening with the idea that they're going to fly to freedom. Life is suffering. The word suffer doesn't necessarily imply a dramatic major experience. Even the nicest day is not free of suffering. For instance, you might have the best breakfast you can imagine. You might see just the friend you want to see. You might go to work and have everything go smoothly. There aren't many days as nice as that. But even so, we know that on the next day, it could be just the opposite. Life presents us with no guarantees. Of course, leaving out the guarantee that we will die. And because we know that, we're uneasy and anxious. If we truly examine our situation from the usual point of view, life is suffering like an affliction. The German philosopher Martin Heidegger said, "Anxiety is there. It is only sleeping. Its breath quivers perpetually through man's being." As long as we're afflicted with the disease of the mind to want what's nice, not want what's unpleasant, as long as we're trying to manipulate our life so that it will work out the way we want, as long as we have our own agenda, we're trying to control what we can't control, what can't be controlled, we're going to suffer. We're going to suffer unnecessarily. We're going to suffer excessively. And she says here, "Now my friend noticed that when there was just the physical pain, there was no problem. The minute she began to have thoughts about the pain, she began to suffer and be miserable." It makes me think of a few lines of Master Huang Po. "This mind is no mind of conceptual thought, and it is completely detached from form." So Buddhas and sentient beings do not differ at all. That is, we all have this mind. Do not differ at all. If you can only rid yourself of conceptual thought, you will have accomplished everything. But if you students of the way do not rid yourself of conceptual thought in a flash, even though you strive for eon and eon, you will never accomplish it. It's the play of our minds, of conceptualizing about anything that happens to us, that is the problem. There's nothing wrong with conceptualization per se, but when we take our opinions about any event to be some kind of absolute truth and fail to see that they are opinions, then we suffer. That's false suffering. A tenth of an inch of difference, and heaven and earth are set apart. We make our life into a thing, make ourself into a thing. We play with our thoughts and believe that they're real. The Buddha not only said that life is suffering, he also said the cause of suffering is our egotistic desire. So the word he used is tanha, T-A-N-H-A, I believe, which means thirst. It's the thirst for things to be the way we want them to be. To have what we like and to avoid what we dislike. She goes on, now a point to add here is that it doesn't make any difference what's happening. It may be very unfair. It may be cruel. All of us have things happen to us that are unfair, mean, and cruel. And our usual way is to think, this is terrible. We fight back. We oppose the event. We try to do as Shakespeare said, and to take arms against a sea of troubles and by opposing end them. It would be nice if it did end the slings and arrows of most outrageous fortune. Day by day, we all meet events that seem to be most unfair, and we feel that the only way to handle an attack is to fight back. And the way we fight is with our minds. We arm ourselves with our anger and our opinions, our self-righteousness, as though we were putting on a bulletproof vest. And we think this is the way to live our life. All that we accomplish is to increase the separation, to escalate the anger, and to make ourselves and everyone else miserable. So if this approach doesn't work, how do we handle the suffering of life? There's a Sufi story about this. At one time, there was a young man whose father was one of the greatest teachers of his generation, respected and revered by everyone. And this young man, having grown up hearing his father speak great words of wisdom, felt that he knew all there was to know. But his father said, no, I can't teach you what you need to know. The person I want you to go to and see is a peasant teacher, a man who is illiterate, just a farmer. The young man wasn't pleased with this, but he went off and traveled on foot, not very willingly, until he came to the village where this peasant lived. It happened at this time that the peasant was on his way by horseback from his own farm to another farm, and he saw the young man coming toward him. When the young man came near and bowed before him, the teacher looked down and said, not enough. Thereupon the young man bowed to his knees, and the peasant teacher again said, not enough. Then he bowed to the horse's knees, but again the teacher said, not enough. So the young man bowed once more, this time to the horse's feet, touching the horse's hoof. Then the peasant teacher said to him, you can go back now. You've had your training. And that was all. So remembering the definition of the word suffer, until we bow down and bear the suffering of life, not opposing it, but absorbing it and being it, we cannot see what our life is. This by no means implies passivity or non-action, but action from a state of complete acceptance. Even acceptance is not quite accurate. It's simply being the suffering. It isn't a matter of protecting ourselves or accepting something else. Complete openness, complete vulnerability to life is, surprisingly enough, the only satisfactory way of living our life. It's also the key to Alcoholics Anonymous, to AA. It's so hard to do because we want to perform well. We want to be excellent people. And continually we get evidence that we fall short. It's been said that Zen is a practice of continuous failure. We go astray, get caught up in aches and pains. We shrink from what needs to be done. And then we feel worse about ourselves because of it. So much of Zen training is just being willing to be who we are, to be where we are. You can't be in this moment completely, completely with it if you have an agenda, if you feel that things should be different. What Joko is calling false suffering comes from feeling that things are not as they should be. I think everybody here is intelligent enough to know that saying that everything is as it needs to be doesn't mean that things can't change and that we can't take intelligent action to make things change. But the fact of the matter is, what's happened has happened. What is, is. And our job is to embrace that. Until we embrace that, we can't really change it on any kind of stable basis. It really comes up in Sesshin. Such an excellent crucible to deal with our expectations and the inevitability that our expectations will be dashed. It's really wonderful. But we don't always see it that way. There's a story I read recently, recounted by John Tarrant, another Zen teacher. He writes, here's my version of a story that I first ran into in the Zen teacher Zenkei Shibayama's writings. And the title of the story is, Thank You Very Much. So here's how it goes. Once upon a time, there was a young man who was deeply unhappy. He had many good things in his life, but they didn't help. When he was at the end of his tether, he heard about a teacher who was supposed to be good with hopeless cases, and he made the journey to see her. I'm very unhappy, he said. I'm too restless to sit still and do a spiritual practice. I'm too selfish to practice compassion and service. I reach for what I want, but when I get it, I'm not happy. I'm always looking out for the next thing. I don't have a clue where to turn. But I'm told that you deal with hopeless cases, so perhaps you can help me. You're my last resort. I'm glad you came, she said. I might be able to help you, but you will have to agree to do the practice I ask you to do. Why don't you tell me, he said, and I'll decide if it will work for me. Oh, no, she said. The deal is that you agree to do what I say, and then I tell you what you must do. There is no other way. He hemmed and hawed and went back and forth, and finally surrendered and said, okay, I'll do it, but I won't do it forever. So she said, try it for a year and let me know. A year? She said nothing. Okay, he said, give it to me. This reminds me of when I stopped drinking and I went for an evaluation, my drinking career, and they surprisingly seemed to think that I was an alcoholic and told me I should do a program of treatment and explain what was involved. It was, I think it was started out two nights a week anyway, for like 4 hours or something. And at the time I had a very responsible job, and I had also, not that long ago, found my way back to the Zen Center, so I was coming for sittings, and it just seemed like too much. And I said, that's an awful lot. And they just said, well, that's what you're going to have to do if you want to do this program. And so I swallowed hard and said, okay. And then she said, and you're going to have to go three nights a week to AA meetings. And at that point, I just laughed, and I said, okay, whatever. That just that moment when you surrender, little surrender, but nevertheless. So the teacher says to him, he says, give it to me. And the teacher says, I'll give you the practice I do myself. Whenever anything appears in my mind or appears in the world, I say, thank you very much. I have no complaints whatsoever. That's all. That's it. That'll never work for me. You agreed. For a year. Off you go now. Thank you very much. I have no complaints whatsoever. So he left, and she more or less forgot about him. Then a year passed, and he asked for an interview and arrived in her room. It's as I suspected. I knew it would never work for me. I'm just as unhappy and selfish as I ever was. Immediately she said, thank you very much. I have no complaints whatsoever. With her words, he felt an eruption in his chest and began to laugh and immediately understood what she meant. And laughed and laughed and laughed, and his happiness didn't subside, although it did become quieter after some months. Thank you very much, he told people. I have no complaints whatsoever. It's such a radical stance. It's actually beyond our capability to be completely okay with everything that happens. But we have the ability to just throw ourselves out there. You know, Sesshin is, like I said, is such a great example. You know, we shrink from it. I certainly did. But just with just a slight shift, we can change and say, okay, give me what you got. Hit me with your best shot. Thank you. I have no complaints whatsoever. Or as Joko said, complete openness, complete vulnerability to life is, surprisingly enough, the only satisfactory way of living our life. And then she goes on and says, of course, if you're anything like me, you'll avoid it as long as possible, because it's one thing to talk about, but it's extremely difficult to do. Yet, when we do it, we know in our very guts who we are and who everyone else is, and the barrier between ourselves and others is gone. Our practice throughout our lifetime is just this. At any given time, we have a rigid viewpoint or stance about life. It includes some things, it excludes others. We may stick with it for a long time, but if we're sincerely practicing, our practice itself will shake up that viewpoint. We can't maintain it. And as we begin to question our viewpoint, we may feel struggle, upset, as we may come to terms with this new insight into our life, and for a long time we may deny it and struggle against it. That's part of practice. Finally, we become willing to experience our suffering instead of fighting it. When we do so, our standpoint, our vision of life, abruptly shifts. Then once again, with our new viewpoint, we go along for a while until the cycle begins anew. Once again, the unease comes up, and we have to struggle to go through it again. Each time we do this, each time we go into the suffering and let it be, our vision of life enlarges. It's like climbing a mountain. At each point that we ascend, we see more, and that vision doesn't deny anything that's below. It includes that, but it becomes broader with each cycle of climbing, of struggle. And the more we see, the more expansive our vision, the more we know what to do, what action to take. Zen teacher said, "Hardship and ease alternate. Therein lies the way." She goes on, "In talking to many, many people, the main thing I notice is that they don't understand suffering. Of course, I don't always either. I try to avoid it as hard as anyone. But to have some theoretical understanding of what suffering is and how to practice with it is immensely useful, especially in Sesshin. We can better understand what Sesshin is and how best to use it and really practice. This mind that creates false suffering is operating constantly in Sesshin. There isn't one of us who isn't subject to it. I noticed it myself last night. I could hear my mind complaining, 'What? Another Sesshin? You just did a Sesshin last weekend.' Our minds work that way. Then, seeing that nonsense, we remind ourselves, 'What do I really want for myself or anyone else?' And then our mind quiets down again. So as we do Zazen, we patiently refuse the domination of these thoughts and opinions about ourselves, about events, about people, and we constantly turn back to the only certain reality, this present moment." Need to be careful here, though. She says we patiently refuse the domination of these thoughts. It doesn't mean that we need to refute these thoughts. We need to prove to ourselves that they're not true. Just need to see them for what they are. They're just our complaints. They're just our agenda, our preferences. Just let them go. Doing that, turning back, our focus and samadhi constantly deepen. So in Zazen, the Bodhisattva's renunciation is that practice, that turning away from our fantasy and our personal dream into the reality of the present. And gradually in practice, we begin to have faith in this present, in this moment. It becomes a refuge, which is remarkable. Normally we think of a refuge as a refuge from whatever is going on. Our refuge becomes what is going on. The dis-ease itself is our refuge, if that's what's manifesting. The incredible value of knowing what's happening, of not looking away, letting the chest open. We can even open to the chest being tight. I just went through a little bout of atrial fib. It's such a revealing experience because constantly wanting the dis-ease, the physical dis-ease that's coming up, and it's not anything that you can control by relaxing muscles. It's, you know, electrical stimulants. Wanting that to go away and be different. It is what it is. And it will change. Happy to see I say I feel pretty good right now. And that will change. Again, so in Zazen, the Bodhisattva's renunciation is that practice, that turning away from our fantasy and our personal dream into the reality of the present. And in Sesshin, each moment that we practice like that gives us what we can't get any other way, a direct knowledge of ourself. Then we are facing this moment directly. We're facing the suffering. And when we really, finally, are willing to settle into it, just be it, then we know, and no one needs to tell us, what we are and what everything else is. Now, sometimes people say it's too hard. But in fact, not practicing at all is much, much harder. We really fool ourselves when we don't practice. So please, be very clear with yourself about what must be done to end suffering. And also, that by practicing with such courage, We can enable others to have no fear, no suffering. We do it by the most intelligent, patient, persistent practice. We never do it by our complaints, our bitterness and anger. And I don't mean to suppress them. If they come up, notice them, you don't have to suppress them. Then immediately go back into your breath, your body, into just sitting, into whatever your practice is. And when we do that, there is not one of us who by the end of this session will not find the rewards that real sitting gives. Let's sit like that. We don't even have to go looking for it. Everything we encounter is grist for the mill, as Roshi Kaplow used to say. Just to be able to make that shift where we're willing for things not to be so great. Have that almost disinterestedness. Not sure if that's a good word. I'm going to read one other thing here. This is from a guy named Anthony DeMello. May have heard from him before. Says, all of this sounds like a new world, doesn't it? No judgment, no commentary, no attitude. One simply observes, one studies, one watches, without the desire to change what is. Because if you desire to change what is into what you think should be, you no longer understand. A dog trainer attempts to understand a dog so he can train the dog to perform certain tricks. A scientist studies the behavior of ants with no further end in view than to study ants, to learn as much as possible about them. He has no other aim. He's not attempting to train them or get anything out of them. He's interested in ants. He wants to learn as much as possible about them. That's his attitude. The day you attain a posture like that, you will experience a miracle. You will change, effortlessly, correctly. Change will happen. You will not have to bring it about. As the life of awareness settles on your darkness, whatever is evil will disappear. What is good will be fostered. You will have to experience that for yourself. We'll stop here and recite the four vows.